The title of my talk is Biomimetic Methods to Measure Bioavailability. We have heard quite a few talks relating sorption to microbial degradation or plant uptake. And mine is more on the integration with ecotoxicity. And there are two purposes here. Mainly, I'm going to give you a little overview about different biomimetic methods that people use. Hopefully that's informative for some of you. And then I'm going to talk about one method that we're working on and something that we're very interested about, which is the use of state isotope exchange or state isotope dilution. Lizzie Cui is my postdoc. She was my postdoc until last Friday. And Laura Delgado Morano, she's a postdoc currently working in our lab. A lot of this data is from their work. So I'm going to talk about the definition of bioavailability. I know that people have gone over that, but I'm going to give you probably from a different angle. And different techniques, again. And I'm going to focus on the use of stable isotope as a technique to understand bioavailability. Well, as we know that in many cases, when we analyze both soil or sediment samples, or when we analyze water samples, we try to be very exhaustive. Doesn't matter if you use sonication or solvent-solvent extraction. And we try to get up to 100% recovery, if not more. Okay, on the other hand, we know that from today's talks that we know many chemicals, metals, as well as hydrophobic organic compounds, they are strongly absorbing. On the other hand, when we look at the soil sample or even a surface water sample, you have really multi-phases. You have the solid phase, you have the DOM, you have water. So physically, these chemicals can be in different phases. And your organisms, for example, we have a picture of Cirrodiaphnia dubia. They can physically be in different places as compared to your contaminants. Therefore, you have this phase distribution-derived bioavailability issues because your organisms and your chemicals are not in the same location. So we have bioavailability issues for the bulk, for example, sediment or soil, and that's just a diagram where the gray shows the solid phase. That's where your most of your molecules will be. Then you have the pore water. That's your DOC, associated chemicals. Then you also have freely dissolved in the pore water, for example. For surface water, you have a similar scenarios, except you have suspended particles, you have DOC, then you have freely dissolved molecules. You have different phases. And this phase distribution drives your, determines your bioavailability. And I'm going to, I'm borrowing this concept from this review paper by Rothenberg and the Mayer. By the way, I think a lot of this work has been done by some European colleagues. I think they have done a lot of good work. And here, what you're seeing here, pay attention to these skinny lines. And here we're basically using an exhaustive method. We're extracting all these parts, freely dissolved, reversibly bond, or dissolvable. Then you have also this irreversibly bond. We try to collect all these parts, and that's normally what we normally do. Then, of course, we have also what we call bioaccessibility. We try to ignore this part because we don't think that's bioavailable. Then we try to measure this, and that's called bioaccessibility. We need a different set of methods to measure bioaccessibility. Then, of course, we also have these so-called passive samplers where we try to just measure the freely dissolved or the immediately bioavailable fraction. And so this is a total concentration. That's normally what we measure. And then we have a set of techniques. We try to measure bioaccessibility by measuring these two fractions. then the passive samplers, in many cases, we try to measure the freely dissolved concentration. So, for bio accessibility, we have a whole set of methods. For example, mild solvent extraction, like this morning Bill Koskinen mentioned about the use of methanol water. That's a mild solvent extraction. Then you have gut fluid extraction in relation to invertebrates, for example. And also we have cyclodextrin extraction. That's the same concept. And also we have 10X trap that Joe mentioned this morning. So those are all partially depletive techniques. We try to measure really the two out of the three parts, which is the bioaccessibility. And C-free, also there are many different methods. We have dialysis membrane, SPMD, semi-permeable membrane device. Then we also have POM. And lastly, but not least, we have SPME, S-P-M-E. And that's one technique that we have used for the last few years. But a lot of studies have gone into this. So basically, you're measuring bioaccessibility or C-free, and both fall under bioavailability measurement. 10X, again, this is just an overview of different techniques. Simply, you have a powder of 10X, which is a polymer, hydrophobic polymer. What you do is you mix this with your soil or sediment sample. And really, the role of 10X here is to trap whatever that's coming off the soil particles. So that really facilitate the measurement. And so the desorption really is still driven by water, just desorption. So you measure this, what you do is you do a sequential desorption for many, many steps, normally for 2 weeks, for example. Then you can fit this desorption curve into this three-phase model. Then you can estimate how much is in the rapidly dissolving pool, how much is in the slowly dissolving pool, and how much is... So you have these many variables, normally you get a very good fit, but you can estimate the relative distribution of your chemical. So this is 10X, and there are many studies. I'll just give you an example here. Talking about aging effect, for example, this we have 7-day, 40-day, 100-day, and 200-day incubation or equilibration. You can see here the F rapid. This is a rapidly dissolving fraction decreased as the contact time increased. So that's really coincides with aging effect. On the other hand, you have this increase of very slowly dissolving fraction that increase as the contact time increased. And just a diagram showing that because over time you have molecules moving to more remote sites. Of course, there are many other mechanisms as well. Cyclodextrin extraction, it's similar to 10X. And again, you know, cyclodextrin here does not really enhance the desorption. People think that because cyclodextrin has a hydrophobic cavity, and this cavity somehow can trap your molecule, for example. So that makes your measurement of desorption easier. And so this is still a desorption thing. And a lot of studies showing that there's a good correlation between the HPCD extraction with for example, microbial degradation. There are many studies like this. Okay, advantages. Those are the things we can do in most labs, since, you know, talking about solvent extraction or just 10X extraction. And they are well related to biodegradation. A lot of studies have shown that. Also, close relationship with bioaccumulation, for example. However, there are some limitations. For example, when you use mild solvent extraction, just what solvents do you use, right? I mean, there's so many different solvents. Even the mixture of water to methanol or the water to some other solvent can change the strengths. So this is operationally defined thing. And also the time, for example. 10X, HPCD, they do not really alter the desorption kinetics, But normally you have to do these multiple steps for, you know, many, many points. It's very tedious. Sometimes it's not very practical unless really you are really interested in this. So, as I said, those are the techniques that people use for measuring bioaccessibility. Then SPEMI, and along with some other things, people have been using for measuring C3. And I'm going to only talk about SPEMI here. I talked about this yesterday. Simply because you have a polymer-coated fiber, and the partitioning into this polymer is selective. That gives you the capability to measure the freely dissolved concentration. And there are two types for SPEMI. And one is the injector type. That's what you can buy from Supoco. And the other one is so-called disposable fiber, because this fiber, this injector type, first of all, it's very expensive. Second of all, it's also very easy to break. So you can buy this fiber, and this fiber happens to be the same kind of material people use in fiber optics. So if you know a company, you can buy this really cheap. Then you can cut this into small pieces. You can expose, for example, in the same container that you use for bioaccumulation test, either earthworms or C10s and things like that. So this is pretty handy. So a lot of studies have gone into this as well. And we have done some work. For example, we have showed that accumulation to PDMS fiber, which is one type of SPEMI fiber, and accumulation into the tissue of, this is Daphnia magma. Okay. In water, you have a very good correlation. You know, given this is biological accumulation, the correlation is really well, is really good. Showing the, also we have done, for example, correlation with SPEMI measurement with acute toxicity. And here again, one thing we did is Wesley, for example, he amended sediment with different amounts of sand, so to create different OC content. Then he measured the BOD residues. You can see the BOD residue, the trend and accumulation onto the fiber, they mimic each other. So this is why we call this biomimetic method. And same thing for some other chemicals. This is C10s. As you can see here, fiber and the BOD residue, the correlation is almost linear. Given that this is biological assay, this is pretty good. And also this is fiber, this organism. You can see, again, very good correlation. And this is sometimes even better than the OC normalization approach that normally people used to use. However, this is, you're ignoring the different differences in the quality of the OC. Okay, SPEMI, first of all, it's non-depletive because you have a very small fiber in the test system. You're not really disturbing the equilibrium, for example. And it's compatible, especially when it's a disposable fiber. It's compatible with many different type of bench tests. And as we have shown, that mimics bio-uptake. Limitations. One big limitation is, this fiber is very hydrophobic. When you put in the, for example, if you want to measure for pHs or PCBs, it takes a very long time to reach a steady state because it's diffusion-based, takes a long time. And also because of that, it's very hard to use this for in situ measurement. So this leads to our, effort trying to use something different. One thing we have been considering for the last maybe 8 or 12 months is try to develop methods based on the use of stable isotope exchange. And the same concept has been used, for example, for understanding the sorption or the labile pool of heavy metals. A lot of work has gone into that. With organic compounds, some work has been done. For example, Joe, for example, he's used the C14 labeled the isotope dilution. Right, also Bill, I know, has used the same approach. A few studies, but not a whole lot. But here we are going to talk about stable isotope. Same concept, same principle, so should work. However, if you use step isotope, you know, you don't have to deal with the radioactivity issues. And also, we think it's you know, it's right nowadays it's a very feasible approach. And well, this is the concept. Basically, you are using this isotope exchange, or the isotope exchangeability, to indicate this exchangeable pool or this bioaccessible pool. It's the same thing. And here, this pool really has two parts. One is your basically C-free, and the other part is a dissolvable pool. Okay, so what we are trying to do is to measure this part. And so basically, your total concentration is made of S here stands for soluble. This is dissolved. This is exchangeable. Then you have this non-exchangeable part, and that's your total concentration. And these two stands for your exchangeable pool. So as I said, you know, using stable isotope nowadays is very feasible because, you know, almost everybody uses GC-MS or LC-MS. And also, nowadays we have a lot of C-13 labeled standards or deuterium labeled standards or even oxygen 18 labeled standards. For example, this Cambridge Isotope Lab, people, you know, just counted how many standards they have. They have over 8,000 isotopes. They even have this step isotope labeled standards for PBDEs, for example, nowadays. So they are very feasible, and also they are not much more than the non-labeled standards for many chemicals. And they're much cheaper than the C14 labeled chemicals. And also nowadays, you know, I know a lot of labs, they're using these stable isotope labeled standards as internal standards or as a recovery surrogates. They're doing this already. So we think this is maybe a good idea. So I'm not going to go into this very much, but really what we're trying to measure is to measure the E value. And the E value really has two parts, which is the dissolved part and the exchangeable part. So E is given by this equation, and here V over M, V is a volume, M is a mass of your soil or sediment. So those are the things that you can easily know. And CS is the concentration of your non-labeled chemical in the solution phase. S stands for the solution phase. DS, for example, is for the deuterium-labeled compound in your soluble phase. So what you, then DT is the total amount of your deuterium labeled chemicals. We're talking about deuterium labeled compounds here. So this is what you know before you add this into the system. And this is something you can measure in the same injection from a GC run or from a HPLC run. So you have CS, you have DS. One is for the non-labeled, one is for the labeled. So in one injection, you can get these two numbers. Then you know the other things, you can measure E. So what we have done is, for example, we have done some work with pyrene D-labeled. We have bifenthrin D-labeled. And for example, here we are, have five different sediments with different OC content. And so what we did is we spiked with non-labeled compounds for 7 days to achieve equilibrium, for example. Then what we did is we took 2 grams of this sediment, then put in this vial, we add 20 ml of sodium azide solution. Then we add the deuterium-labeled chemical here, standard. Then mix again. First thing we want to do is to look at how long you really need to reach a steady state for the E. And we have taken samples at different times. Okay, this is the E on the y-axis. This is the time. And what you can see here is for different sediments, you have different kinetics. Okay, and for different chemicals, you have different kinetics. For pyrene, you have the E is higher than for bifenthrin for the same sediment. And one thing here we want to know is, you know, how long you need to equilibrate to shake the sample. And here you can see that 48 hours, after 48 hours, this becomes constant for almost all the sediments, all the both chemicals. And also for the E, you can see that the E decreased as the OC content increased. That, of course, is very much in line with what we have been thinking. And, of course, it's not a linear relationship. But 48 hours is good enough. So here we have tried to validate this. You know, we say this is a good biomimetic method, but you have to really show evidence. We have done studies to compare this with, for example, Tanex extraction and also SPEMI measurements and some other things. One thing we have done is also try to validate this using this bioaccumulation factor, or the biota sediment accumulation factor, which is we measure the chemical. In this case, we used C14 in the bod tissue, for example. So this is our BSAF for pyrene, and this is our E. You can see here there's a real good correlation between bioaccumulation to C10-10s, which is a benthic invertebrate. And correlation also is very good for bifenthrin. And we think, you know, this will be a very good approach, except, you know, we still are doing a lot of work to further optimize this technique. And I think this is, you know, it's a simple concept. And take advantage of the wide availability of stable isotope-labeled chemicals. And I think once it's done, we can really apply this for a lot of things, for example, to understand aging effect. And also, I think very interestingly, maybe, is try really to use this to understand the bioremediation endpoints, you know, when it's enough, and things like that. And by the way, we just got a grant from NIEHS to apply this, to develop this method, and also to apply this. To understand, for example, DOM sorption. And yesterday, Bao Xin gave a very good talk on the DOM, you know, this competitive, non-ideal sorption. You know, we try to understand is DOM sorption, HOCs are bioavailable or maybe partially available, what really controls that? I think that's a topic not very many people have really looked at. And also, we can couple SPEMI with this idea. We can preload the SPEMI fiber, and that way we can really use the SPEMI in a very short time frame. That's something, you know, that's a different talk, so I'm not going to go into that. That's my group. Thank you.